Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 186. What happy women know.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So then women start to put a little fine line in the sand around how they're going to structure this career. So first they start off by saying, okay, I'll graduate from college, I'll work for a few years, I'll get married, I'll work for another few years, and once I have this title and this salary, then I'll have my first child, then I'll take some downtime, then I'll come back, then when I reach this salary level and this title, I'll have my second child, and it goes on and on and on, and we start staging our lives at the cost of our own, perhaps, reproductive happiness and reproductive satisfaction. And then there are many women like me who are happy with being productive and generating what I might call useful energy for the universe. And I find children everywhere.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Kathy Greenberg, nationally known speaker, executive coach, and co-author of What Happy Women Know, How New Findings in Positive Psychology Can Change Women's Lives for the Better. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Kathy Greenberg, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here.
Well, along with Don Baker, you're co-author of a book called What Happy Women Know, How New Findings in Positive Psychology Can Change Women's Lives for the Better. As someone with a long affiliation with humanistic psychology, I've been very interested in the positive psychology movement, and I previously interviewed some people whose names you might recognize, for example, Jonathan Haidt, John Drimmer, Judy Salzberg, and James Pawelski. Have you run across any of those folks?
Yes, I have. And of course, in doing the New Science of Happiness as a book series, we often come across wonderful folks who we do, you know, adore and love their thinking. We just don't get to meet them. So I can say I know them virtually. How's that?
That's good. That's about how I know them as well. So to start out, tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be involved in positive psychology.
Well, it's a real human interest story, if I can say that myself. I was a happy working woman. I was a happy mother and a happy wife in a very, very large consulting firm, and was traveling pretty much on a regular basis, both domestic and international, making what I think our U.S. population would consider probably a salary in the upper 5% of the communal, pay scale.
Sure.
And, by all means, I was considered very successful. And then one day in 2003, I just hit the wall of life. I basically went through a very difficult divorce, wound up paying a settlement. I lost a child in my seventh month. Both of my parents had died in my arms, very, very recent deaths apart from each other, one on Father's Day and then Mother's Day, respectively.
I guess. Oh, my goodness.
My loving parents wanted to make sure I would not forget them, not that I would. I had a very successful executive career with this global firm. I was living in an 8-bedroom house on a very large estate. I had about 24 people maintaining the property on a regular basis.
Oh, my goodness.
Any indication how big this place was. My spouse at the time was an executive at a very large financial institution in New York. And I was diagnosed with two potentially terminal illnesses, and all of a sudden I woke up and said, something is not right with my life. I am, by all measures, David, I was considered successful.
Yes.
But the reality was, if you look underneath the covers, or as they say, peel down the the sides of the onion, there was something that was not quite right. And so I was very fortunate. The angels of the universe was looking over me, and it said to me, you have an opportunity here to self-correct, make some choices, or just stay on this merry-go-round or the roller coaster. And thank goodness I had the good consciousness to take a break. And at the time, my firm IPO'd, and my bosses came to me with great love and affection and said, you know, my dear, you don't have to do this anymore if you don't want to. So I took a break. And that year took me on a journey to many places where I did self, I guess, kind of, what would you say, assessment, self-assessment.
Sure.
And I found the new science of happiness at the hands of Dr. Dan Baker, originally out of Canyon Ranch, and progressed on that journey as an individual and found wonderful people in the area of positive psychology like Martin Seligman and Barbara Fredrickson and Sonia Lubomirsky, and I just said, wow, this is for me. So I started writing about happiness from a perspective of someone who had it all but wasn't happy and now who is happy and by all means and measures is still considered, you know, what we would say in society successful. So that's how I came to be where I am.
Well, that's a really fascinating story. And, of course, we've heard a lot from this new science of positive psychology that affluence and happiness are not correlated, certainly not nearly to the extent that most of us assume.
Oh, absolutely. And, in fact, I worked on a special with Dr. Sanjay Gupta a couple of years ago called Happiness and Your Health. And the producers had engaged my help and support behind the scenes as a researcher. And if you go to www.cnn/happiness.com, you'll see the top-rated countries in the world in a global assessment of happiness using a culturally, if you will, kind of appropriate definition for happiness. And you'll notice, David, that the top five countries are countries that would not be considered socioeconomically elite, and they are all Spanish-speaking. So it's fascinating to me that you are absolutely correct. We do not have a strong connection between economics and happiness at all.
That's something that's really going to be increasingly important to keep in mind as we go through the current economic crisis, which is global in scope. And I've started to kind of ask myself, and I'm thinking of also of my listeners, of what kind of, you know, messages I can put out there that kind of reminds us all that we are in control of our happiness rather than at the effect of, you know, everything that's going on around us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, David. And I have a friend by the name of Lisa Kamen who has a program called What Is Your Happiness? And I love her saying, she always says, happiness is an inside job. It is not something that is external to you. It is something that is internal to you. And as we know, the research that has come to light in the past several years is also linking genetics to happiness. And therefore, regardless of the economic circumstances that any of us find ourselves in, if we rely on our own internal clock for happiness, and we just assume for the basis of this discussion that it's a 50% chance that we're genetically happy, we can increase our happiness because the other 50%, which we call maybe the nurture part instead of the nature part, is actually what we do with our intentions every day. So 40% of that 50% of nature something we need to think about. On the side of the equation where we can actually control what's going on, our intentional activities have more to do with our happiness than anything else. So if we spend 40% of our time engaged in really, really truly happy intentional activities and just recognize that 10% is situation, such as gas prices or, you know, the economic situation that we find ourselves in, we have a lot more control over our happiness than we actually think we do.
Maybe we need to step back just a moment and let me ask you, what's your working definition of happiness?
You know, that's a really great question. My working definition of happiness is when the choices I am making really engage my happiness. So I know people say you shouldn't use the word in the definition.
That's right.
But I know, but when my choices are engaging my happiness, that's how I know I'm happy.
Well, give us an example of what you mean.
Well, often, and we write this in our book, What Happy Mothers Know. We're working on a new book called What Happy Working Mothers Know. And so I'm so focused on that book right now. I have to take a step backward and reflect on What Happy Women Know, which is a little bit of what we're talking about today. But in that book, we talked about happiness traps. And traps of happiness are things that we believe give us a sense of happiness. But when we look, if you will, underneath them, they are actually traps that hold us and prevent us from being happy. So maybe we can talk about some of those. Would that work for you?
Sure.
Okay. So one of them would be people-pleasing. We know that people-pleasing is a social modified behavior that we all learn to do because it brings us into the group. It socializes us and helps us become part of what we might call a tribe or a family or some group that we want to socialize with. But when people-pleasing is done to the extent that it's damaging your own happiness, it's time for you to take a look at why you're doing this, who you're doing it for, and is it really delivering on your sense of purpose? And for me, the choice of people-pleasing and knowing when I'm doing it brings me some happiness, but knowing that I have the choice not to be a people-pleaser is one of the things that I hold near and dear so that I know that when I'm going across that line, I can pull back and recognize this isn't good for me. I may be making somebody else really happy, but it's not making me as happy as it should. So that's an example of how I make choices and mm-hmm. how I relate to my own happiness. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And, of course, the title of the book is What Happy Women Know, and that raises the question of, are happiness issues different for women than they are for men? And certainly you just mentioned people-pleasing, and I think we all know that women tend to be probably more socialized in that direction, and maybe even genetically pre-programmed a bit more than men in that direction.
Oh, absolutely. And, with somebody of your your background I think you're a psychologist.
Right.
Is that accurate? Someone with your background, I'm a behavioral scientist, so I'm not technically a psychologist, although I practice what we might call positive psychology through my behavioral work with people. But you are absolutely correct, and let me help a little bit define what that means. There are gender and generational differences in the measurement of happiness. And if we look at happiness from an evolutionary standpoint, we know that there are portions of the brain that can, when stimulated, create happiness. Oh, my goodness. We got a little bit of an alarm going off here. But the idea here is that when we look at the evolutionary behavioral journey of men and women, we can see clearly from historic perspective that men fear not having enough, which would be a measure of their success, a measure of their, if you will, power, and their ability to provide for others. Women fear not being enough. Women are very social, as you said, very well, and our archetypical titles and roles in society as mother, as daughters, as sisters, as friends, as caregivers, often have been an overbearing weight for us to carry. But the reality is we fear not being enough. Are we being good enough mothers, good enough sisters, daughters? I could go on and on. And that translates into the workplace as well. Are we good enough employees? Are we good enough bosses? And so we often don't realize that while fear is a true key motivation to survival, it has been for a long time. So our brain is hardwired for hard times. Men fear not having enough. Women fear not being enough.
That really makes sense to me, particularly in light of a conversation that I had recently. I'm in a dream group, and the other members are women. And we were kind of reflecting. I think I'd read somewhere that men worry about not getting enough love. I think that kind of dovetails with what you're saying, and that women worry about not being lovable enough.
Oh, beautiful.
And the women in the dream group, they just really lit up to that idea and affirmed that, yes, that was exactly what their concern was, that they somehow weren't lovable.
And it's so funny, if you think about our past from about 4 million years ago when our brains were fully developed as we know them today, it's only been in the past 10,000 years that we have really created the what we call executive brain, which helps us to rationalize why we would have those feelings. Because up until that time, we really had the limbic system, which is the oldest part of the brain, the root of the brain, that is, you know, the oldest part of the brain, kind of manifesting those fears. And so it's only been very recently with the executive brain in the prefrontal cortex that has been able to help us rationalize those things, that we get to measure them and do that with some intelligence. So it's fascinating that when we use a dream state or a state of consciousness that doesn't have, you know, the capability of rational control, because the executive brain is resting when we're sleeping, that those fears come more closely to our souls than they are when we're in waking states.
Yes. Now, the chapter titles of the book are very provocative. Let's step through some of them and have you expand a bit on each. For example, you have a chapter on perfectionism. What's the issue there, particularly in terms of women's happiness?
Well, that's one of our six happiness traps that I started to talk about. We talked about people-pleasing. Perfectionism is rooted in people-pleasing. Perfectionism is not understanding the difference between doing something well and doing something to the measure of idealism that we might have or others might have about us. And in that chapter, we talk about the ways that women can help themselves to understand why we get caught in perfectionism and the happiness trap that perfectionism drives us to. It does not make us happy in the end. In fact, perfectionism costs us greatly. It costs us time, energy, and we're just not investing in our intentional activities, as I described before, and we aren't necessarily really delivering on our sense of purpose. We're kind of delivering on an expectation that's probably unreal. So that's a big one for women.
Okay. Now, another chapter is titled Wanton Wanting. I like that. Wanton Wanting.
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, the myths and burdens of affluence, which we've already touched on, but we really didn't talk about this idea of wanton wanting, which is almost reminds me of the Buddhist stance on desire.
Yes, well, you know, I've been doing a little research on Buddhism, and I'm sure you can make the connections better than I can, but, you know, we always believe that things will bring us joy.
Yes.
And we always tend to believe if we save up, if we sacrifice, if we scrape and we, you know, make ends meet, and that allows us the extra money to go buy something that's going to make us extraordinarily happy. And then we do that, and that action does not result in the expectation of happiness that we had. It pushes us into states of such unhappiness, it's almost on the borderline of minor depression. Now, it only lasts for a short period of time, but so too often does the happiness that we get from acquiring something that we think will bring us joy. So, you know, often we'll save up and buy that new house or buy that car or buy that designer purse or a pair of shoes or a piece of jewelry. I mean, you could go on and on. And all of a sudden you sit back after you've acquired this thing and you go, it doesn't make me as happy as I thought it would. In fact, now I have the bill to pay.
Yes, right.
And I'm not sure if I've really calculated appropriately or planned accurately. So the wanton wanting is a way of being that many of us get into that we think helps us. And many of us call it retail therapy now. I mean, we've actually created a diagnosis for it.
Right, right. Right. And of course, it doesn't help that we have created a society that is constantly stoking that, you know, through advertising and so on.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, especially with the holidays upon us, we all get caught in it.
Right, right. You also talk about what you call, I'm also intrigued by your chapter titled, When the Good You Do Doesn't Do You Any Good.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on there?
Well, that is often when we think we're doing good for others, and we often take away from ourselves, and that is a little bit of the people-pleasing. But it's also the idea that when you really look at the activities that you're engaged in on a regular basis, is it giving you energy or is it taking energy away from you? So here's an easy exercise that your listeners can do, perhaps when they have a free moment. And we would suggest that you get just a plain sheet of paper and write the names of people that you love and spend time with, that you perhaps work with, that you perhaps socialize with, and put a plus or a minus next to the names of those people, and I would keep this piece of paper in a very safe place.
Yes, really.
And then I would really candidly take a look at when you have left the presence of these individuals, whether it's a phone call, an email exchange, or a personal interaction, have they left you energized, which would circle the plus, or have they taken energy with them that really is yours, and that would be the minus? And when you kind of get this down on paper, you can start to imagine where your energy level might be and where your good might be done if you could see where the energy you have to use is being expended. And what you can do, David, is you can start to look at those people you want to spend more time with because they give you energy, and start to mitigate, you know, be very careful and thoughtful about who's taking the energy, and think about whether you really need to spend as much time with those individuals. We call those the energy vampires.
Yeah.
Sometimes we call them drama queens. Those are the people that engage us in their, what they think is happiness, by taking us on a merry path, but often we leave exhausted, and that might not be good for our ability to do good.
Well, that really does sound like a worthwhile exercise. You've also got a chapter called The Revenge Rut. Is that particularly an issue for women?
Well, this is a big one for me right now. I am working with a wonderful woman whose name I won't mention. She is the survivor of a family kidnapping in South America, actually Central Mexico. Central Mexico. She and her husband were unfortunately abducted one day, taking their small children to school, and he was held for 7.5 months in captivity before he was released. This individual is a hero in my book. She has been able to use the forgiveness process that we talk about in our book, and that a famous and wonderful writer by the name of Dr. Michael Berry at Cancer Treatment Centers of America has been working on in all of his caregiving books. And Cancer Treatment Centers of America came into contact with this very special woman as a result of the following. You can't imagine, David, but 7.5 months of being held hostage and having your life and your family held hostage can be a huge drain on you personally and emotionally, spiritually, physically, and mentally.
And certainly lead to fantasies of revenge.
Exactly, and that's exactly what happened to this young woman. Her husband was returned. He weighed about 90 pounds, and they had life threats against them, and so they had to leave their country, their family. She had started a Waldorf school, had to take her children, ages 8 through 13, and just leave. So she's left everything. She was an American citizen, so she's been helped and aided by our police force, and certainly they're still working on the case. But the reason I share this story is when she was happy and her husband was returned to her, within 3 months she was diagnosed with a very serious case of breast cancer, potentially terminal. She went to several hospitals who would not help her. she finally got to Cancer Treatment Centers of America. And the first thing they do is an assessment of your spiritual wellness, because as we know, the revenge rut, holding a grudge, is no more than a different variation of stress and anger. It blocks the immune system, and you can't get your treatment if your immune system is blocked. So she worked with Dr. Michael Berry, who is someone who I just highly admire, and he helped her with a forgiveness model that she took to heart through meditation and journaling. And she took these criminals from their birth and envisioned what they would be like if they were truly kind human beings. And it was through that process that she was able to forgive. And she is captured on videotape for those of us who have access to Cancer Treatment Centers of America. And I'm a board member there. And the story is very compelling. She talks about her need to forgive so that she could open up her immune system, and how she now has been taking her treatments, and she's on a road to remission. And she really believes that it was the ability of Dr. Michael Berry to instill in her the idea that revenge is harmful and forgiveness is creating a whole being, that allowed her to heal. And I cannot stress to the people who are listening, you don't have to be sick to understand this model. You just need to know that each and every one of us has the choice to forgive. It doesn't hurt you. Revenge only keeps you in a place of stress, and it's not good for you physically, mentally, spiritually, and it really is something you need to do. It's forgiving yourself and letting go. It doesn't mean the other person's off the hook. It means you're off the hook.
Yeah, really well said. That's something I heartily agree with you on. Moving along here through the book, you have a chapter called I'm Nothing Without Him.
Well, you can put anything in the I'm Nothing Without box. Do you know? I'm sure you have many listeners, David, who have children, who have a career, who have a home, who have a paycheck, who have family. And you can put pretty much any name of any object in the him box. Mm-hmm. But we know that most women really feel incomplete without someone in their lives. And that's not a judgment I'm making. That's just an acknowledgement of the experiences that I have had. And it could be a her. It could be anyone in that box. For me, I know having my daughter, might be the proper person to put in that box. But the point is this. What would I be without is no more than an idea that you are no one, nothing, a non-entity, an unimportant person, unless you have an identity attached to something. And we know that that is so misleading, because if, in fact, we are all that we can be in this lifetime, we come as complete human beings, we come as complete souls, if we choose to share that identity with others, that's wonderful, but those other things that we identify with should not define us, and having those things disappear from our lives should not make us any less happy. And that's a really good one, especially for women who have made their life's journey being attached to something that makes them feel important.
Yes, it brings to mind, I have a friend who, he was going to go to Europe, and for whatever reasons, he's not been very successful in developing relationships with women and long-term relationships. And I think I had remarked about one of his planned trips to Europe. I said something along the lines of geez, is it going to be any fun going alone? And he said, why not? I'm good company. I'm good company for myself. And I kind of internalized that, I thought about that, and I thought, well, yeah, because I'm alone a fair amount of the time. And so I've tried to remind myself that, hey, I'm good company, and I need to enjoy myself at that level.
Beautiful. That's well said. And, unfortunately, historically, women did not have official titles and official roles unless they were someone who was married to someone with an official title or an official role. And it's only been in the last really 50 years since the Industrial Revolution, we are now in the knowledge era, that women have really gained equality. But even with that, David, only 2% of women in the United States are on boards, and only 2% of women nationally are CEOs and hold the official title. So we are still in positions in many cultures of our society where that title is very meaningful. And I know of women who get divorced and they still introduce themselves as Mrs. So-and-so because it's the identity that they feel most comfortable with.
Interesting. You also go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so, you know, this is, I don't want to make, again, judgments against anyone who's listening. I'm just trying to explain with, and from my standpoint, a very optimistic view that we are who we are because of the wonderful miracles that we have become in our growth and our journeys, and we don't need to have a title or belong to a particular group or organization to continue that happiness and that journey.
Yes, yes. Well, you've been a career woman. We started off talking about your early career, and in some ways, it's, you know, you're still very busy. You're on boards, et cetera, many initiatives going. In your chapter, Circling the Career Track, you look at the relationship of work and happiness for women. What have you learned about that, both objectively and also, I guess, in terms of your own life?
Well, that's a really deep question, David, because in my life, I think I'm a prime example of someone who's given up reproductive success for productive success. Mm-hmm. And at the root of that is, you know, reproductive success would be my ability to have children and nurture and grow a family, because, of course, that's what we're here on Earth to do. That is part of our genetic predisposition to create. We, in the work world, get very caught up in our career track, on our career track, on our career journeys, and often our productive success, our ability to be successful in what we do in the work world, prevents us from having satisfactory reproductive success. We either put off having children too late in life. We, as I did, had problems carrying children because of the, I guess, extreme travel that my body was experiencing during my pregnancies. And sometimes you just don't think about what you're doing. And you start to think about the possibility of having it all, but your body is saying, I'm not sure if you can have it all. So then women start to put a little fine line in the sand around how they're going to structure this career. So first they start off by saying, okay, I'll graduate from college, I'll work for a few years, I'll get married, I'll work for another few years, and once I have this title and this salary, then I'll have my first child, then I'll take some downtime, then I'll come back. Then when I reach this salary level and this title, I'll have my second child. And it goes on and on and on, and we start staging our lives at the cost of our own, perhaps, reproductive happiness and reproductive satisfaction. And then there are many women like me who are happy with being productive and generating what I might call useful energy for the universe. And I find children everywhere, globally, nationally, in my own community. And I don't mean children per se, but I mean people that I have helped through a period of time that kind of connects them to me. And that's how I've been able to balance that reproductive success with productive success.
Okay. I was surprised to encounter a chapter on transcending loss. Somehow, if I sat down to outline a book on happiness, it would not have occurred to me to have a chapter on loss.
You know, that's fascinating. I've been through a lot of loss in a short, I guess it's even hard for me to talk about, in a short in a short life. I still have a fairly good bandwidth to go, but I think I have felt just about every potential loss there is. And I have to say that the idea of loss has to be relabeled, revalued, and kind of reassessed. Because we often think of loss as something that goes away. For me, loss is something that I have had for a period of time, but then the generative memories and the delight of the experience prior to the loss takes over, and the remorse is diminished, the grief is diminished by the pleasant memories and the experience prior to the loss. And if we can teach everyone through just a small reading in a book how to generate that level of beauty and contentment, even though you don't have the physical entity, the person, with you any longer, to me, that's a huge success.
So there's some way in which we can hold loss that perhaps deepens us and sort of creates more soul, if you will.
Absolutely. And if we look at the experience that we've had from a positive vantage point, and we think of the time that we had with that person or that thing, you know, it could be a dog, a cat, a pet of some kind. If we can hold the positive attributes of that person and build on those feelings, they're always with us. They've never left us. And if we just try to focus on those aspects of loss, you'll find a true transformative experience in looking at the word loss and elevating your consciousness to be able to understand. While grief is a natural state to pass through, it can help us broaden and build on the positive aspects of that person that can be with us, well, forever.
You've talked about the cancer work of the man whose board you're on, and you also have a chapter on health and happiness for women. How do these two interact for women?
Well, it's very important, especially for women who are such wonderful providers of care. You know, historically, we look at the roles that women have played in society, and we've always been supporters of others, providers for others. And those of us who are currently in households where we're between the ages of 45 and 55, often we have both children and parents that we are taking care of at the same time. And the health aspect is so crucial. I mean, here's a statistic for you. 81% of U.S. citizens, or the U.S. population, I might say, not citizens, had cell phones in the year 2007, yet only 15% of that population had a membership to a health club. We are very social beings. We are very relationship-based. We will tend to do things with a team member, with a peer, or with a group. So we'll go to a health club if we have a buddy. We will go to a resort to do, kind of a recovery immersion program if we have a buddy. Cancer Treatment Centers of America will only treat a cancer patient if they have a loved one with them, because they know that a loved one helps them make better decisions. So it's very interesting to me that women have not really truly engaged in their health and then wonder why they're not happy. It's very difficult for any woman to be able to feel incredibly healthy and very happy if they're not getting three things: good food, nutritious food, great quality sleep, and good relationships. And those are three things that they can control, and they all lead to much healthier lives and much healthier spiritual beings.
That's really fascinating. Now, towards the end of, I think it's the last chapter of your book, there are lots of quotes from, I guess, famous women, and I wondered, did you do some focus groups or invite them to respond by email? What was your methodology of gathering that information?
Well, that's a really interesting question, David, because we thought about how we could capture thousands of voices of women. You know, Dr. Dan Baker, who was at Canyon Ranch for 20 years, saw thousands of women over his lifetime. Now remember, the people that can come to a health resort are generally a very economically stable group of women. So we couldn't just use the voices of that community because it's a very elite community, and it might not represent the thinking of the average woman. My experiences over the years in business, working with people who are hairstylists, customer service reps, waitresses, and of course the Fortune 500 executives, allowed me access to many, many women over the years who were very excited about lending their voice to this book. And so, if you will, I was the voice of reason behind the writing of the book, even though the book is written in the voice of Dr. Dan Baker as a therapist. And we had put out a request to many of the women that I knew in my career along the way and asked them if they would be willing to be interviewed to participate. And we were very fortunate. And I think of myself, again, as very fortunate, having met these women over a long career and a period of life who welcomed the opportunity to give us a perspective. And so those that were willing to have their names printed, we got permission and we did so. So that's how we did that. We did not do focus groups. We really did interviews and then used Dan's experience from 20 years as a life enhancement coach at Canyon Ranch and then my, you know, almost 20 years of experience as a woman in both industry and in family to create those comments. And then we had people who were willing to make a comment help us do so with their own voice.
Yeah, yeah. Some very nice quotes in there. Now, you mentioned coaching. I'm curious about the coaching that you're doing now. You've kind of positioned yourself as a coach as well as an author and a public speaker. Did you, by any chance, go through the positive psychology coaching training that was set up by Dr. Seligman?
You know, I wish I had, but no, I have not. I have a very hard-nosed consulting background, if you will, in large global companies, both Computer Sciences Corporation and Accenture. We use program management. We use lots of different methodologies and approaches to executive alignment, leadership development, organization transformation. And we're talking about, if you will, David, multi-million dollar engagements. Now, that's the business side of the equation. When I started to look at where many of our companies that we were working with were going off track, it was in their ability to be aligned on what it was they were doing. And so I started working with the senior level executives in these Fortune 500 companies to help them understand their profiles, how they liked information, what made them more emotionally intelligent, and more capable of interacting with a broader array of executives, and harness that as a series of methodologies that Accenture turned into what they would call their own programmatic way of doing project work, whether it was global outsourcing or merger and acquisition work, whatever it was. So I started creating methodology for that organization as a behavioral scientist. Now, when I left the work world, I already had under my belt quite a history of doing this kind of coaching. And I went to the College of Executive Coaching in California, which is run by Dr. Jeffrey Auerbach. And one of his instructors is Dr. Relly Nadler, and came across these gentlemen and got my certificate in coaching, both personal and executive coaching. I have followed the positive psychology sciences since 2003. I'm a member of the International Positive Psychology Association and the International Coach Federation, and in fact, I've just submitted a paper for the upcoming International Positive Psychology Association meetings, which will be held in July in Philadelphia. So, you know, I can't say that I have been formally educated by that organization, but as you can hear in my voice, there are many organizations that do coaching and what we would call college-level programs using positive psychology.
Yeah, the part of the reason why I'm asking is I know I have listeners who are either involved in coaching themselves or maybe who are considering that as a career option, So what sorts of people are you coaching these days, and what kinds of issues, and how are you getting your coaching clients?
Well, interestingly enough, I have a wonderful reputation from having been at Accenture, and many of the clients that I had at Accenture asked me to continue to help and guide them, and I do that on an ad hoc basis. I also have a rich coaching client base that I create from my network. I don't particularly do a lot of sales. I have a website called www.h2cleadership.com. Often people go to that website because it comes up when you Google happiness or coaching or leadership, and they will contact me that way. I have been the Yahoo Seeds for Success entrepreneurs competition mentor and coach for this year. And for those of you who don't know about the Yahoo Seeds for Success program, Carolyn Koepscher, who was on The Apprentice with Donald Trump, left that show as his executive vice president and started her own company called Finding What Matters. And she and the Today Show announced last April that they were going to hold a competition for three women entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very exciting, and I got to be a coach with Kathy Black and Bobby Brown. And we have been the Yahoo Seeds for Success coaches for this year. They have picked a winner. I don't know who has been announced at this date, but I'm very proud of that. I'm also an executive expert on the Women to Women link. That's www.link.com, and we have an expert circle of working women who talk to us daily about things that are of interest in their lives. And then my my new co-author, Barrett Avigdor, and I are creating a whole coaching program around what happy working mothers know with the launch of our new book in September.
Okay. Now, what does H2C stand for?
H2C, that's little h, lowercase h, the number 2 and lowercase c, is kind of a little formulary for our company, and that is happy companies, healthy people. So it's the two H's from happy and healthy and the C from companies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we have a little motto that happiness equals profit, both professionally and personally. And we believe that in our book, What Happy Companies Know, which was written before What Happy Women Know, we looked at 90 companies that demonstrate a series of principles. And those companies that demonstrate those principles do, in fact, have a higher level of profitability because they have a higher level of happiness inside their organizations, which, interestingly enough, decreases stress, lowers healthcare costs, and increases profit.
Well, we might have to talk about that on a whole other podcast. So as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with?
Well, I'd like to say that I hope that those of you who are listening do the energy audit. That's a really simple thing to do for yourself. I think you have a lot to think about. My problem in life is adding too much value in a short amount of time, and I'm going to have to learn how to handle that a little bit more masterfully. But I do hope that your listeners have enjoyed hearing a little bit about the book, and I hope they look forward to our new book in September of 2009, What Happy Working Mothers Know.
Well, Dr. Kathy Greenberg, thanks for the added value. Thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been an honor, and I hope to talk to you and your listeners in the future.